we go. Hello, everybody. It's Bill Buckmaster with you, along with Tom Fairbanks. Together, a big welcome to the Buckmaster Show on this Christmas Eve Eve. There you go, Tom. I got it.
Christmas Eve Prime.
Yeah, there you go. It's Thursday, the 22nd of December, 2022. And Tom, I don't think we could ask for a better Christmas gift than the weather we're going to have over the holidays. Look what's going on back east. Unbelievable.
Well, the majority of the country, fully a, what, as much as 80% of the country is 80, being affected
85, they
by
say.
This.
85%. We're in the minority, and that's the minority I'll take. Certainly beautiful weather. Okay, we'll celebrate 12 full years with the Buckmaster Show at the end of the year. We'll launch into Lucky 13 in January. Our program broadcasts from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio as part of the Bustos Media Tucson Complex here, one of four radio stations that we have at Bustos Media. We're 1030 Tucson's Voice for Trusted News Talk, our worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. And when we do our telephone interviews, our live line presented by Rincon Ventures and Real Estate Management. Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, the Buckmaster contributor on agriculture and professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science, is our lead guest today. Jeff has served on the UA faculty and worked statewide since 1987. Professor Silvertooth has been recognized as a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy and Soil Science Society of America. Jeff, how are you?
Very good, sir. Thank you.
How are the holidays shaping up for you? It's such a frantic time of year, isn't it?
It is, but it's a good time.
It's
kind of hard to mess up a holiday like this, but, you know, some of us have the capacity to do that, but it's great, and the prospects are good.
Arizona is preparing. We've talked about this a lot on the program. Arizona preparing for the first time to enter the 2A shortage for the lower Colorado River Basin. Right. The cuts will begin at the start of the new year. And unfortunately, we're all fearing that this is like the first shoe to drop and the second one's coming.
Well, it is. And there is more to come, undoubtedly, in relation to the fact that the flow on the Colorado River has been significantly diminished, like 27% less than what it was through most of the 20th century over the past 20 years. And as a result of that, our two big reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, are below 25% capacity. And that seriously threatens both our sustainable water supply in the Southwest in a very immediate sense, and also power supply. It's very important with regard to the power generation that comes from the water in that river, from the hydroelectric dams at Mead and Powell, and some of the other dams on down the lower basin as well. So it is serious. Significant cuts are obviously coming. They probably best force bill if they come sooner rather than later, but there's a lot of negotiations going on. I'm not party to them directly, but I am affiliated with some people that are, and I just know that it's pretty intense. It's very intense.
Here are some numbers for our listeners, Jeff. As you well know, the Tier 2A will mean a reduction of 21% of Arizona's Colorado River supply, about 9% of the state's total water use. Cities that use Colorado River will see a 3% reduction. The tribal nations, the First Nation people here in Arizona, will be reduced by 7%. Now we come to agriculture. And of course, this is going to be a big impact on farmers and the way they work out ways to operate with less water.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, the tier one reductions came into place in January 2022. And for Arizona, that was 512,000 acre feet reduction in our CAP, or Central Arizona Project allocation, which comes out of the Colorado River. And that reduction is directly, in fact, input into directly impacted the agriculture irrigation districts in Central Arizona, principally Pinal County. And so with this Tier 2A, that's another 80,000 acre feet, but it brings us up to 592,000 acre feet. at this Tier 2A total for reduction, Tier 2A from including Tier 2-1, then the add-on to Tier 2A. So it's 592,000 acre-feet. Now, that's in a context of 2.8 million acre-feet that comes to Arizona out of the Colorado River, out of a total water budget of about 16.5 million acre-feet, or right at 16.5. And that's divided with 7.5 million acre-feet in the upper basin, 7.5 million acre-feet in the lower basin, that is up below and above Lake Powell. And then 1.5 million acre-feet goes to Mexico, primarily Sonora and Baja California in the Mexicali Valley. So collectively, there's 16.5 million acre-feet budgeted. The river's been flowing at about the tune of about 12.3 million acre-feet. So there's about a 4 million acre-foot differential that we've got to try to figure out how to deal with just based on environmental constraints. And that's part of the problem is that our challenge is can our systems of governance deal with this fast enough, effectively enough, to keep us from running into, like, we don't want that river to crash. I mean, where you can't pull water out behind the dams and you can't get hydroelectric power. And we're getting precipitously close to that. So we've got to move on this pretty fast.
The agriculture industry is valued here in the Colorado Basin at $15 billion a year. This is huge. Arizona farmers provide a good portion of the leafy greens that the entire country and Canada eat. And speaking of leafy greens, a lot of folks, I'm hearing a lot of grumbling, they're paying up to $5 a head for lettuce. What's going on?
Well, there's several things there. Is that, well, first of all, Arizona agriculture is worth about almost $24 billion based on really good economic estimates from our economists. And secondly, Arizona produces in the wintertime from November to about March about 90% of the leafy green vegetables. And that's all your lettuces, all types of lettuce, cauliflower, broccoli, spinach, cilantro, you know, celery, all of that. It's coming out of the lower Colorado River Valley, primarily Yuma and to some extent Imperial Valley this time of year as it transitions from Salinas. Now, when you talk about the prices that we're seeing today, that's basically a supply-demand situation.
Is it water-related or no?
Not so much right now, and okay. That gives it. But it does. It's a harbinger for what may come to pass in the future. Very likely could. What's happening right now is the Salinas Valley, where it's just the production center for this leafy green vegetable industry from the spring and summer. You know, from when Arizona finishes up in March, and then they pick that up in the Salinas Valley. They go to the Huron Valley, California, then Salinas. And the Salinas Valley this year had a really tough time. There are two big diseases that hit them. This one that's an INVS, I forget the name of it myself. I butcher it up if I said it. It's transmitted by a thrip as the vector. And these thrips were flourishing this last year because of the warm weather. The weather was just ideal for them.
A
little thrip insect, slender, very slender, like it's just a few millimeters long. Mm-hmm. These thrips have piercing mouth parts, and they carry that virus in their systems, kind of like mosquitoes do with malaria.
Yeah,
and they could transmit this virus across the plants. So they were devastated by that, and a disease called Pythium. Both the conditions were just ripe for both those diseases, so they got wiped out. And that disease has been carried over now into Arizona. Arizona's starting to experience that in the lower deserts. And that Pythium, the thrip, we've had a fall that's been conducive to this here in Arizona. And so we're getting this INVS virus that's hitting us as well as some other diseases. Actually, in the vegetable industry, insects and diseases are extremely important with regard to trying to protect a crop, not just to keep the crop alive, but to keep it presentable, because the American consumer wants a pretty plant in the field.
Yeah, they want a pretty head of lettuce.
Yeah, so any kind of damage on the leaves, and it basically throws that lettuce out of the market.
How do they get rid of these pests, I mean, and still stay within environmental limits?
Great question. Some colleagues of mine spend their entire career working on pest management with regard to insects, weeds, and diseases. There are cultural practices you put into place, and that's hard to do here. You know, sanitation of crops is really important. When you finish a crop in the field, to clean it up, disc it up, you know, incorporate that residue into the soil. Basically, don't give the insects and the disease a host to continue to be harboring in. Sometimes it's chemical control. And when it comes to chemical control, it's very important to point out, in my course of my career of 36 seasons here now in Arizona, there are capacities with regard to chemical control has changed so radically as like it has in medicine, where they have now very targeted prescriptions for these insects, very laser pointed prescriptions for the insects that quite often are materials that don't damage us as mammals at all. 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. We were using carbamates, organophosphates, and they're nerve toxins.
We're throwing lots of stuff at this.
At one time, but that's improved and changed dramatically. So friends of mine are working on that radically. However, the problem is those things are expensive. They're expensive controls. The other big tool for disease control, particularly, is for variety developed through genetics. And people get uptight about, you know, changing plants. But that's how we do. We breed our way out of these things.
Yeah, you hear a knock on, in part of your industry, something called genetically engineered or modified.
Yeah. Well, we've been modifying, genetically modifying plants for 12,000 years, we as being human beings. When people start collecting grasses and improving them so they can become more like wheat and corn, the crops that we're growing today, and we continue to do that. So that's still probably one of our most powerful tools with disease resistance, is look for varieties that have resistance to these diseases and breed them out. However, the problem is that takes several years to get. And so what we're dealing with right now is we have the varieties at hand, and this stuff has hit us pretty hard.
All right, we're going to take a break right here. 790-2040. Any questions for Dr. Silvertooth? He would be happy to entertain them. But right now, Jeff, we want to talk about Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. How about a Kringle on Christmas morning? That sounds good, doesn't
it? Sounds great.
Or even Christmas Eve morning, or even Christmas Eve
yeah.
morning, like today or tomorrow morning. All right. Mona's is open right now for lunch. They open for breakfast at 6:30. On Sundays, they open at 7 for their Sunday. And, of course, it's not too late. We put in our order yesterday for a cherry pie for our dessert on our Christmas table. How about making an order for your dessert and what you would like for dessert? And Steve and the team can accommodate you. Mona'sDanishBakery.com. We'll be right back with Jeff Silvertooth.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. We always enjoy our monthly conversations with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth. He is our contributor on agriculture and professor and extension specialist in agronomist and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science. Jeff is an agronomist and a soil scientist, and we want to ask him about, well, torn from today's headlines, or maybe it was yesterday, Jeff, under the headline, New Water for the Desert. What do you think of this consortium? I guess it's a group of private investors based out of Israel that wants Arizona to sign off on its proposal to build a $5.5 billion seawater desalinization plant on the Sea of Cortez near Puerto Penasco, also known as Rocky Point in Sonora. And I guess then it would, what, be like a pipeline up here?
Right, yeah. Right, that's what they're proposing. Is
to this bring for real or what?
No, it is for real. It's real in terms of it's a real discussion. It's
okay.
It is being developed out with regard to, you know, feasibility. And the group that you're talking about, the IDE Technologies from Israel, they are the ones that are proposing this large plant that would produce up to eventually, when they get it all done, up to 1 million acre feet of water. And the Arizona entity that's been engaging with this is called WIFA, or the Arizona Water Infrastructure Finance Authority. And that's an authority that's existed within our state government since 1998. But just this past year, it was augmented and revised to expand and be able to deal with this water shortage, this critical water shortage that we're facing. And the governors in the House of Representatives, the legislature, or our legislature, their interest was to find some mechanism within our state government to try to direct some money to help Arizona augment our water supply, find additional new water sources. There's been several discussions on that. One is desalinization. One is a pipeline from some river like the Missouri or the Mississippi and bringing that out to Arizona. So this one's getting traction. And WIFA, it was reconstituted this year to form a 9-member board. It's a political entity within the state. They put in $1 billion out of the state budget this year to WIFA so that they can have that to work with for 3 years, I believe, and look for possible investments. So they're exploring this technology with this IDE. And there's been a lot of controversy, as you can see from those articles, that this was a backroom deal done by the governor and some of our politicians, and then now they're pursuing this with this Israeli company. What they are saying is that, no, they said all we did was we're just looking into this. This company is exploring it, and we've expressed an interest in working with them if they are able to bring that to fruition. Of course, there's a lot to go on there. There's, of course, this entity called the Mexican government that you have to work that out with as well. And this would also supply water for, if it comes to pass, for Hermosillo, for Nogales, and I believe other parts of northwestern Sonora.
One of our listeners just sent me a message, Jeff. Desal plant is the most horrible waste of money ever. Bad idea. What is the negatives on this?
The two big negatives with desal are the energy requirements associated with making that happen. It's basically reverse osmosis. Almost any big desal plant's going to be a reverse osmosis process, so there's a big energy requirement for that. Secondly, there's a brine residue that's resulted from that. So you take seawater, and you push that thing through all that volume of water through a membrane that holds all the solutes back, all the salts, so to speak. That salt is left on the original side, on the intake side of the membrane, and you have to then dispose of that salt. Now, however, in relation to that argument against this case, when you're right at the sea, you can haul the brine out to the sea and put it right back into the ocean, that salt back into the ocean and carry the fresh water away. So that's what's done in a lot of parts. That's what the Israelis are doing primarily over there in Israel. They have, you know, worked on this technology quite a bit. So the viewer is correct. There are downsides to it. There's like anything, it's a package deal. Energy and brine are usually the biggest drawbacks to that.
So in perspective, Jeff Silvertooth, 1 million acre feet of water would be as much as the CAP project delivers yearly to Arizona.
Just about, yes.
So that's a lot of water.
That's a lot of water.
Yeah.
If it were, but it won't be immediately available. I think it's something like 250,000, 60,000 acre feet that would be available right away. Mm-hmm. But it would be in probably 5 to 10 years if they build this thing out as proposed today. Mm-hmm. It could possibly bring in 1 million acre feet, and we could be one of the customers to purchase some of that water, perhaps. That's what's being explored.
Well, of course, Mexico would have to sign off on
absolutely.
This. Yeah.
Absolutely. They're going to get water out of the deal, rightfully. Yeah. And then, there's a lot. You know, water law in the United States is complex. It's hairy. It's very complex. And what we're dealing with out here in the West is a good example of that. Then you add to that international agreements, international law, and it just adds to that level of complexity. Possible, but just still a negotiating challenge.
Getting back to our lead topic about the Tier 2A water requirements that kick in on January 1, let's talk a little bit about the Bureau of Reclamation and their role in all of this. They've been talking since the summer about additional protection measures needed, and they keep pushing the can down the road.
Yeah.
What's the thinking? What are you hearing about what they're planning?
Yeah. Good
this
good
is a
point.
Big deal, isn't it? What
yeah,
they're going to finally decide on this?
Yeah, it is. It's a big deal. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so that's there are a lot of phases to that picture. Just to kind of help our viewers, listeners remember that in June, the commissioner of Bureau of Reclamation, Camille Towton, came out and said, we're 4 million acre feet short on the river, as I described earlier, and we're going to make some adjustments on this. We have gave the basin states 2 months to work out a plan. So until August, they had all the basin states. Well, all the basin states couldn't work it out in 2 months. So everybody was on pins and needles, you know, by the time August 16th came around, and then the undersecretary for the Department of Interior, Tommy Boudreau, came out and said, well, what we're going to do is just go to Tier 2A, which was going to happen anyway. So basically nothing. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they've had meetings in Santa Fe. They've had what they call the Colorado River Water Users Association met in Vegas, and they're working on that right now. And it's pretty complex. I think the Bureau ran into a situation where they realized, you know, these bureaucrats, honestly, I think this is Jeff Silvertooth's take on this from what I've been gathered. They just got into it and realized how complex it is, and that basin states weren't really going to come to an agreement on their own. And if they're making a decree from the federal government, it's going to be tough because there's water law. So some advocates just say follow the law. The law of the river is a complex amalgam of laws and contracts, agreements that have been developed in the past 100 years, starting with the 1922 Colorado River Compact. And so others say, no, we need to go in and redo the compact, redo the whole thing. And the federal government's kind of caught in the middle of all this right now, and they're realizing it's extremely complex. You make one move, you're going to get sued. Go in the federal court, and you got to wait for that thing to get adjudicated. In the meantime, the river's drying up, right? Mm-hmm. And so they've got to come back and say, well, some people then turn around and say, the only way we're going to get this solved is if the seven basin states of the United States and Mexico can get in a room and get this thing hammered out. But the folks that are in those rooms tell me that, man, they're very contentious meetings, and people just don't want to give. And so someone's going to have to come in and someone's have to give and compromise in a significant way. And Arizona's already given more than any other state with regard to, you know, what we've tried to put behind Lake Mead. So it's got to transpire pretty soon. But this is a real test on our systems of governments, water governance in this case. Can we work this out? And what's the role of the federal government to come in and deal with this?
Of course, would you have the growth here in Arizona? The genie is out of the bottle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, the two big factors, here's the deal. Here's one of the big rubs, is agriculture uses about 80% of the water on the Colorado River. And you have these cities are growing, and so there's some folks in the basin, and there's some very vociferous entities that are saying, kill agriculture right now, but we're good in the desert. We don't need it here.
Is that now You're hearing that.
They're serious about
it. They're saying this is the end of the road for Arizona agriculture.
That's some people are lower basin agriculture is what they're saying, desert agriculture from the Colorado River. Some people advocate that. Of course, I don't agree with that. Of course, many, obviously, I have a bias. But also, I'm American and I'm a citizen, and I can look to see what were the realistic impacts on our food supply. And do we want to do something like that that jeopardizes the capacity of future generations to be able to produce food locally within this region and support themselves? I think not. And I think it's an example of the detachment that we have. This is a little bit of my editorial, I guess, Bill, but the detachment that we have with American public in terms of truly understanding where does our food come from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do here in sessions like this, is help understand that. So that's a serious rub on the whole equation right now, is the agriculture versus urban.
And this is a situation that will just be the lead story probably month after month next year.
Or water in the desert, absolutely.
Does the Bureau have the ultimate authority, but I guess each state is going to say, well, there's the water law. Who does have the ultimate authority?
The ultimate authority will come back to the federal government. For example, anything, contests that go on there, it goes to federal court for adjudication. And so it's a federal issue. But the states have rights, and individual entities within those states. Like, for example, on the Colorado River, some of those irrigation districts have the longest perfected water rights on the Colorado River. And they say, here's the law. Follow the law. You can't just throw all of a sudden decide, well, we don't like it anymore. We're going to throw the law out the river, out the window. Well, then that has to go through a legislative process and be ratified. So it's complex.
We'll see where we're at in a month or so you come back with us in January. Meantime, let's all enjoy a beautiful Christmas and Hanukkah and holiday season. My best to you and your family. All
likewise,
the best.
Bill. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll take a break right here. Be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. There is still time to get over to Green Things. They do have some poinsettias left. They grew 20,000. They went very quickly this year. 3384 East River Road. That's the address for Green Things. Conveniently located at right by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. We love Green Things. They've been in business 52 years. They'll start their 53rd year in January. 13-acre site, also home to Zocalo. They've got some beautiful items for Christmas, imported Talavera pottery that has been made into some beautiful lamps. And I think they may have a few of the punched tin Christmas trees left, which are neat. There's a light that you put in the middle, and it really is nice, and you won't have to worry about buying a Christmas tree every year. GreenThingsAZ.com and ZocaloVillage.com. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Father Robert Hendrickson is with us, rector at St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church. He's our faith and spirituality contributor. I am a proud member of St. Philip's, really a wonderful worship center in our community. And the folks at St. Philip's have had this community spirit. It's not like they got off the bus yesterday. The church goes back to the 1930s, right, Father Robert?
1936, actually. Wow. Our first service was Christmas Eve, 1936.
Oh, my goodness. And if folks haven't been in and looked at the interior, it is truly a work of art. It's one of the buildings that the famed architect Josler designed. And when you look up at the ceiling and the beams, you can just see those were like, what's the word? Hand hewn beams. But anyway, did see some of your Facebook pages about the posting on the greening of the church. Looks really great. So you're all ready.
We probably bought about 1,000 of those 20,000 poinsettias from Green Things.
From Green Things, yes, so. Indeed. So what are you thinking this Christmas time? There were a couple of words that have kind of jumped out to me, and I wanted to kind of share with you and our listeners, incarnation and resurrection.
Yes. I feel like I'm in seminary again. Thanks, Bill.
Other words, you can't do Christmas without Easter.
Absolutely. And actually, both are kind of mirror images of the same miracle. You know, if you look at the Latin for incarnation, it's carne, right? It's flesh. I mean, so the Word was made flesh, incarnated, and Jesus comes back in the flesh, sort of in the resurrection. And so those two things are put together, and really the Christmas Eve begins this sort of story, but the story is Easter and beyond. And in some ways, the story is the way the story continues to unfold is by how it unfolds in our lives, right? Sort of the best translation of Scripture is the way you live your life. And so in so many ways, that Christmas Eve is the beginning of the story, and it's the chance for us to sort of commit again to let Christ be born in our lives and to share that good news with the world around us and to figure out what that means for us in our individual lives.
So Jesus stepped into the world, whether it be in December or, as some scholars now say, it had to have been in the spring. It really doesn't matter exactly where on the calendar, does it?
No, you know, if my wife makes a pan of brownies, I don't care if they were cooked Tuesday or Wednesday. I just want to eat them, right? You know, so in some ways, the wonder that has unfolded is the thing that we put our attention toward.
So let's talk a little bit about a season of light. In Christianity, of course, Christmas is associated with light, as is the Hanukkah, which we now have overlapping. And to all of our Jewish friends, certainly we want to wish them a very happy Hanukkah. But Hanukkah is known as the season of light.
Well, I think those themes of sort of light and dark are sort of deeply embedded in the human consciousness and sort of deeply embedded in the way we view the world. And you know, in so many ways, I think religion began with people giving thanks for making it through the night. I think all the faith traditions have that narrative, that story, that sort of duality sort of built into them. And for us, you know, the prologue to John's gospel, there's this sort of famous line, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. And for me, that's kind of held resonance over through COVID and through all the stuff we've sort of been through in the last several years, sort of holding on to that verse and holding on to that promise in this time feels more important than ever.
You've got to have faith, and the faith is the would be tying incarnation and resurrection certainly together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, so when
I mean, taking the stories mm-hmm. of Christmas and Easter, you have to have faith to take that.
Absolutely.
To take those stories.
Absolutely. And that's the sort of great gift and miracle is you can sit with the stories themselves, right? I mean, so it's possible to read them as a sort of, you know, a kind of mythological narrative, something that maybe has some relevance for you in some way or another as a story. But I think for believers, it sits at a deeper level. And that deeper level is at the kind of heart level, the kind of gut level, the soul level. And I think it's when we make the choice that story is going to shape the way we live, that our faith begins to really take bloom. And so, you know, for many of us, it might just be a story we hear, but I think the way faith tends to work is that we hear it again and again and again, and it gets planted deeper and deeper and deeper until it really takes root and changes who we are, until it really sort of shifts the way we see the world so that the light is not the thing we look toward alone, but it's the light by which we see the rest of the world illuminated. And so that light becomes the way we see other people, the way we see creation, the way we see our lives. And so when we talk about a season of light and we talk about faith, it really comes down to sort of having the faith that God has planted a goodness that we can see.
You mentioned Christmas Eve, and I was reflecting with Greg. I'll bring up Greg Gehringer, our production guy. We were talking about the hecticness of this season, and both Greg and I agreed, Father Robert, that after all is said and done, all the hecticness of going out and getting the last-minute shopping, there seems to be a stillness. Of course, you can't stop time. Time moves on, and time marches on. None of us can stop it. But there seems to be a stillness that takes place on Christmas Eve.
Absolutely. If you listen to music, one of the most profound moments is, especially after a sort of a crescendo or some particularly raucous piece of music, is that moment of stillness just after, where you really appreciate what it has taken to get to that moment. And I sort of think that's what happens on Christmas Eve is the tree is decorated and the presents are bought, and there's not one more thing you can get delivered from Amazon, no matter what time they're delivering.
You know, you will not get instantaneous.
Exactly. No.
I need it now.
Right.
Nope, that is not
going to
happen.
No, even they stop for the incarnation.
Yes.
So there's that wonderful moment where I think real thanksgiving and gratitude can settle in. A kind of an appreciation of the people around you, an appreciation of all the moments of life and the traditions and the blessings that have brought you to that moment. And the sad thing is it's often such a brief window. There's a story about a new nun who goes into an order, and she's talking to the Mother Superior. And the Mother Superior says, well, you need to go pray quietly for an hour. And so she goes off and prays quietly for an hour. And then she comes back. She said, well, I was only able to experience God for about 30 seconds. And the elder nun says, well, that's why you pray for an hour, to have the 30 seconds. And in some ways, I feel like that's what the season is, right?
Yes.
This is the season of preparation, the season of kind of busyness, because it begins to focus our attention and focus our energy. And it also begins to give us a need for rest, a need for pause. And I think it's in those moments of stillness and quietness that God speaks the most profoundly.
You brought up a word we talked about for our Thanksgiving session, beginning with gratitude. Maybe before you begin handing out the gifts and tearing into them, maybe take a moment to reflect on all of your blessings since last Christmas.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are so many things for us to be thankful for in our lives, and I think part of the discipline of faithful living or spiritual living, not even necessarily faithful, the discipline of our lives really is about gratitude, because I think sort of most of what we do wrong in our lives, what Christians call sin, really comes from a lack of gratitude. And so I think part of what we always are being called to do is to refocus and recenter our attitude to be one of greater and deeper appreciation for the gift of life itself, but then also for the blessings that come to us. And one of the things about a period like COVID, or like an illness, or like so many things that happen to all of us over the course of our lives, is that they remind us to be grateful even for the smallest things. I was talking to someone not long ago who had been told they would be a quadriplegic, and by miracle, that did not happen, and they're able to walk and able to function. And they said, you know, I never thought I'd be grateful to be able to walk from my recliner to the refrigerator, right?
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
Just that small act becomes something that with the right kind of attention, becomes something you can be profoundly grateful for.
Did a medical person tell this individual that they were going to be paralyzed?
Yes, initially.
Oh, boy. That gets me into a whole nother area about some of the things that are, we love our healthcare people and their health practitioners, but my only advice to any of them that are listening, be very careful with your words, because those are often the things that the patient remembers long after you've left the doctor's office.
Absolutely. I've told this story, I think, to you before. I was working as a chaplain in a hospital, and there was someone who the doctors had assured us was brain dead and couldn't, you know, couldn't make sense of anything. Mm-hmm. And the family asked if I would pray with her. Mm-hmm. And so I visited for about 2 weeks, and it turned out she had been a kind of lifelong, very traditional Roman Catholic. And so she preferred the sort of old Latin rite. So I read the prayers in Latin when I went to visit her. And then I walked in one day, and she was up and talking, and her family was there. And I said something, hello, or something like that. And her eyes immediately turned toward me, and she said, "You're the one who's been praying with me."
And she was supposedly...
Yes.
Supposedly. Brain dead.
Yeah, yes. So, you know, whether that was a miracle or not, I don't know. But thank God that the doctors were wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll continue our conversation with Father Robert Hendrickson as we prepare for the Christmas holiday. Be right back.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the DoubleTree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com. Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Our friends over in Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico, want to wish all of the Buckmaster Show listeners a happy holidays. And please consider maybe over the holidays, some time off, a drive over to Silver City, only about a 3-hour drive. Or in 2023, make a great road trip to check out all of the wonderful things to do, hiking in the Gila National Wilderness and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument, just hanging out in historic Silver City. They have at the museum there, at the Western New Mexico University, the finest collection of Mimbrace pottery in the world. So there's not just outdoor activities, some great indoor activities as well. Their website, southwestnewmexico.org. With us in studio for his annual Christmas visit, our faith and spirituality contributor, Dr. Robert Hendrickson. You know, Father Robert, talking about outdoor activities, that's kind of a good way to kind of unwind after all of this, just getting out in nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My hobby lately has been sort of building things at the house, and so that's been my main exercise lately. But
how about a nature walk?
Yeah, nature walk. I think there are so many different ways. The nice thing about this time of year too, in Tucson, is that there are so many ways to go out and enjoy nature that are a little more difficult in the summer.
We talked about this when you were with us on Thanksgiving. If you know someone alone or lonely this holiday season, why not connect with them? That could be the best holiday gift of all.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many folks here in just in our communities and even next door that are lonely. I mean, so much so that there's been a minister appointed in the British government who's a minister whose sole job is to focus on chronic loneliness. And so I think there's something sort of endemic in the kind of Western condition, for whatever reason, that people are more isolated than ever. And our family ties are just different than they used to be. Kids move away and all that. And, you know, people go off somewhere to retire and they move somewhere without family around. And so it's your chance to be family for them if you can.
We've talked about this before, that there's approximately 30% of the American public that consider themselves strong, church-going people. Then you have nominal, perhaps, folks that maybe only visit on holidays. But are you at all concerned about folks moving away from formal religion?
Well, as an Episcopalian, formal religion is our stock and trade, so I guess I am. I'm not really. And let me say a little bit why. Sort of the whole history of the church sort of involves these sort of peaks and valleys of religiosity. And actually, it's often the peaks of religiosity that where we are at our least faithful. And so I think it sometimes takes these kind of dips in attendance or in participation for a small group of faithful people to show what it means to live differently from the wider world and from the wider culture. And that's the thing that becomes attractive and that draws people back in. So I don't have a whole lot of anxiety about the sort of attendance questions because, you know, ultimately the church is a metaphysical thing. I mean, I don't know how many churches there are in Ephesus right now, or how many there are in Tarsus, or how many there are in, you know, over the course of our history. Churches are planted and grow where they're needed, and then churches sort of grow somewhere else when they're needed somewhere else. So that doesn't give me a whole lot of anxiety. And the other piece of it I think that is important is I don't know that people are less religious so much as perhaps they're just being more honest. Because I know a lot of people over the course of my life, and I'm sure you do too, mm-hmm. who went to church because that was the social obligation.
Yeah.
Well, that isn't the case anymore. There's not a social obligation to go to church. Mm-hmm. And so I think people are just able to be more honest about that. And, you know, I would love to see them, you know, in church every morning on a Sunday. But if their sort of faith journey is taking them elsewhere, then God bless them on their journey. And but, you know, I think that the ability to be more honest is probably also being reflected a little bit in some of the numbership.
In the post-World War II period, maybe up until the late 60s, it was good for business for some people to appear at church. And so you got to, you know, so that was like maybe a motivating factor for some people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so you just don't have that anymore. You know, what I think you do have now, though, is folks who perhaps are getting a first look at church or a first look at faith or a first look at spirituality, who perhaps weren't brought up in it. And so they're bringing fresh eyes to it and bringing sort of new gifts that the church, you know, hasn't had an opportunity to sort of have as part of its the kind of mix in its community before. And so there are folks who will come to our church who've never heard of the word Episcopal, who have no idea what it is. So they don't come with preconceptions about what that means. They come and they want to be faithful. They want to follow Jesus. They want to live in community. And so that I think there's a new opportunity for churches who are willing to kind of embrace that to allow their identity to be shifted by the folks who are coming.
So many of our childhood memories shape the way we view Christmas, correct?
Absolutely. It's funny. I have a memory when my chief memory of Christmas, the kind of dominant memory for me, was my father had moved away and my parents had gotten divorced and my mother had gotten quite ill. And I remember sort of sleeping on the couch in the living room and opening my eyes, and there was the Christmas tree and there was the door opening and my dad returning from wherever he had been. And for me, that's the image of Christmas. It's from when I was about 9 or 10 years old, like this image of sort of family coming back together in that moment. And I think all of us probably have moments like that are kind of, you know, that are how we define or how we remember the holidays. And I think so often the anxiety of Christmas is trying to recreate those in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what's so magical about so many of those moments is they're not the forced ones. They're mm-hmm. the things that naturally happen in sort of life together.
Maybe we should lower our expectations. You know, the old Norman Rockwell painting about everybody gathered around the table or around the Christmas tree. Maybe we ought to just lower the expectations and just try to have a Christmas season that where we do some reflection on our own lives and how we can make our lives better.
Well, absolutely. You know, and I needed that sermon. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
You
could use that down the road.
Absolutely. I'll send you royalties.
Okay.
It's true, though. I mean, I think all of us get caught up and, you know, for me, it comes down, it's about decorating. So I'm very particular about the way things are decorated, as you will see when you come to the church.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of constantly have to sort of catch myself and say, is this really the most important thing right now? And I think we could sort of apply that to a whole lot of things. I mean, mm-hmm. What I remember is my mother used to get really, really anxious about the holidays and sort of, you know, get really angry. And so that's another one of my memories of Christmas is her sort of getting mad about this, that, and the next.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you know, do you want your kids to get the perfect Christmas you've manufactured or to be able to spend time with someone who is sort of, you know, embracing the time together with gratitude and with thankfulness? I leave it up to the listeners to decide that.
What are you doing for Christmas at St. Philip's?
So we have services at 3, 5, 7, 9, and 11.
Whoa.
Three is a Christmas pageant. 5 is a kind of Christmas story where the kids put together the creche. 7 is a traditional lessons and carols service. And then 9 and 11 are the kind of traditional midnight mass, Christmas Eve midnight mass at 11, and then 9, Eucharist. And so there's a nice sort of variety in those. And then the 3, 7, and 9 are all live streamed as well. And if people come to the 3 o'clock, there's a toy drive. And so as part of the pageant, we have kids bringing up toys to donate. So if you're looking for a way to give back to the community, that's a wonderful way to do that.
Also Christmas morning.
10 a.m. on Christmas morning. We'll be there.
All right. All the best to you. Merry Christmas to you, Father Robert.
Merry Christmas to you. Blessings and blessings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show. On behalf of Father Robert and Tom on the other side of the glass, engineering and producing our show, hope everybody has a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, a very happy holiday season.